go back a minute.
Okay.
And the incident of your grandfather getting shot on the porch. Mm-hmm. Now, how did that all come about again?
Do you want to turn that off for a minute?
Now, what were the circumstances of that?
It was October 13th, 1863, the day of the main battle. There'd been several skirmishes along the guard area, but the day of the battle, he was hoping for the Confederates to take over. And actually, they may have taken over had they followed their directions that they were supposed to be following, because they had a large group. We had conflicting numbers, but a large group had come into Falls Mills, and if you've seen the falls, you can cross on the falls. Okay, some of them crossed to come down the other side of the river. Some others came across then and came across the hill. Well, the ones that came around the river, they didn't realize, you know, they were going to have a lot more tributary and area to cover. So they came down and hadn't got yet to the Confederates were on the Snopes farm, as I knew the farm, you know, as I was growing up. They had their trenches over there, which was opposite the Union trenches. So they were trying to get to their location. And the group that, in splitting the group, part of it came across Curry Ridge and over to Millstone. And in coming across that way, they always said they found a still. Well, here, just a couple weeks ago, Wilbur Vitt up here at Falls Mills. Now, we called him Vitt. Veith is the name they go by today. He was down at the center. I wasn't there that day, and Pat had showed him the slideshow and told him, you know, that it was, you know, a story that they had found a still. Wilmer said, yes, that was my granddad's or great-granddad, whichever, still. And it was supposedly one that he was making legal whiskey for sale and paid taxes on it. So they had gotten into it, and it wasn't ready yet, you know, to be run off. And they'd gotten into that stuff and drank a lot of it and filled their canteens. So they arrived a little bit ahead of the time and didn't wait for their assigned signal that the others were in place. They charged because, they, you know, if you get a little whiskey in you, well, you can do a lot, many things that you might otherwise not do. So they charged, and the others weren't in place across the river. So chances are they would have done much better if they had just waited until the signal, but they didn't do that. So I'm so sorry about this, but I can't help it.
That's fine.
So Wilbur just verified what a story that I had always been told. But, I mean, us kids had always been told. But they wondered, said, how come they never told you who still it was? And I said, that's because we were kids growing up. And if we'd gone out and said that his grandfather, they were church people then, that his grandfather, great-grandfather, was running a still, we'd had kids in an uproar. And kids can do strange things. So they never told us that. But they always let us know, you know, that they got into the still. And had they not gotten into it, why, they would likely, everyone arrived at the right point at the right time. But you see, that main battle actually was on again, off again for a day. You know, you pulled out your wounded and your dead, and the Confederates got several people killed because when they charged the outside boundaries, you know, the two sections of the guards, those just went on to the fortification and woke the rest of them, and they all got in their trenches, and that's where they had the advantage, because you wouldn't bring them out of those bunkers, because that was logs up on the sides and across the top with dirt over the top with your holes, you know, left to shoot through. So there was no way they was going to bring them out there. So it really didn't do them any good. It was stupid for them to come in there and try it. But who knew that when they, in the beginning. And by the way, we had people, troops moving north and south. And that was a fortification kept supplied. And with the information, you see, there at the telegrapher office, they knew the movement of troops. And if the Confederates were moving troops, they just notified a group someplace at Clarksburg or someplace, and they would send in a group of troops to apprehend them, maybe at Salt Lake Bridge or someplace else, before they even came to the bridge, the old wooden bridge. I can tell you exactly where the old wooden bridge is, and I know that now you can see the abutment that is on the fortification side, because part of it is still there. And if you'll stop along 19, New 19, where you can look over at the bathing beach, where the foot marker is, you can see part of the old abutment. It's still there. And it's right up and to the kind of to the right of that is where the...
I'll look for that.
Yeah, it shows in the wintertime. Of course, they've already dropped the water a lot now. So I looked yesterday, and you can see a lot of the stonework. Mm-hmm. They've taken down part of it, but they've left just enough, you know, till you'll know where it is. But
I was thinking, now, on that day of the battle, you described how the troops got mixed up a little bit, got there in their time. Well, then at what point... did your grandfather, or what part of the battle did that?
It was during a day when, you see, when they had started their battle, then they had gotten some people killed. They called a truce. They sent in a flag of truce. And that way then they got to pull out their wounded and their dead. But it was when the battle had broke out again, you know, when we won't accept it. It'll be when hell freezes over, when we give up, you know. So that's when it started up again, that he thought, you know, that the Confederates would take him. And they didn't. So that's when he ran out. It was during the day. But that thing went on and off during the day until they even telegraphed for doctors out of Weston. And one doctor and a druggist came. And they took care of the Union troops. Then they that were wounded, they also took care of the Confederate troops and my great granddad too. And then my great granddad and my granddad helped to bury the dead Confederates. There was five or six of them. They buried them in our family cemetery. Then later, across the river, Dr. Levitt Farm. He was also a Confederate, and I never did know why, but he. He had them taken up and put in a single grave on his farm and had a stone, cut stone thing put around him, you know. And then when the Corps, of course, that family's long gone, you know. So when the Corps bought that piece of property, they took those graves then and took them up to the Confederate battleground site and buried them up there. So they're still in a single grave, of course, actually moving them third time, well, what have they moved, but they put them in a single grave and they have a monument there to them. So, but my granddad, he remembered so well, you see, because he was 14 or 15, plowed the trenches. And you more or less heard so much from him because he was a boy. He may have been a bushwhacker, I don't know, but he never mentioned carrying a gun or anything like that, but he helped to run the farm. And I've often wondered how they kept from starving to death in 4 years. They just had to be good providers, that's all. But I heard a story told me probably 2 to 3 weeks ago where an X-Line boy from up at Falls Mills that used to live up there, Roy X-Line, his dad was Frank X-Line. They lived. They had a restaurant, and their home was right there across in front of the falls. You just walk out of their house and watch the water tumbling over, you know. And he was in, I believe he and his wife live in North Carolina, anyway, one of the Carolinas, and he was in. And he related a story to me that had been related to him that I didn't know, although it's possibly true, that my great-granddad was in the Masonic Lodge, and that both of the Confederates and the Union troops were both Masonic, and that he was kind of like newspacker between the two and kept peace in a lot of places that might have turned dirty. I didn't know whether it was so or not. And he told me, too, that he had an agreement with them when they came in down there, that my great-grandfather had, that they would not destroy his fences any more than just absolutely had to. They would leave him his farm. So apparently he got the farm some. But he said it was because they were all Masons. I don't know. I know my family didn't. I know that my dad was in the Odd Fellows, but I don't remember my grandfather being in any of the organizations. He was always on the school board and district school board and justices of the peace and overseer of the poor. And I mean, if it was an appointed office, he got it, because I guess it was something like where the governor knew, you know, some work he had done or something, he got appointed from the governor's office a lot of times. But there was always, I mean, that house down there, I doubt if there was ever a week went by that there wasn't people in and out of that house on business. He was notary public. Either on business, he was writing wills, writing deeds. Fact is, a man just was here a couple of weeks ago and brought me a will that my great-grandfather wrote for his great-grandfather, and they were brothers. And he brought me a copy of the will, and it's taken from deed book, I mean the will book from over at the courthouse. And I said, will you sign it? And he signed it and dated it then that he'd given it to me. Because, you know, their handwriting, I don't know where we've lost it, but man, those people could write. And they were intelligent people. They had to be. Where was the education coming from? A school didn't last that long. They weren't college people. They weren't professors. They were actually almost self-taught. They would have had to have been. It seems unusual because when we bought where we did live, when we bought that, the lady asked me, she nor her husband, neither one could read and write. Their granddaughter took care of everything except pricing the place and accepting the money, and she counted it and made sure that that was correct because we paid in cash in front of the man that was writing the deed and everything. And she said, would you like to have our original deed? Your grandpa wrote it. I said, I sure would. So she gave it to me. So I've got writings from my granddad and great-granddad, too, which to me is kind of important. And the man that was working for this summer down here that has this called me one day, and he said, I will get you a copy of the deed for my property. And he said there was a lot more of it in the beginning, something like 1,200 and some acres that my great-grandfather over on Clover Fork, my great-grandfather had deeded this to, he and Phoebe had deeded it in 58, I believe, the same year that the Weston Gully Turnpike Road was finished. And he told me the price, and he said that was a lot of money back then, but he has found it in tracing his property. But there was 50 acres right in the center of it along the Turnpike Road that had been reserved for a certain party, a Bill Bacorn. And so far, I can't find anyone that knows who Bill Bacorn was. I've got to go to Lewis County and check records over there and see if I can find that 50 acres and see who he was. I wondered maybe if he wasn't married to one of the great-granddad's sisters or something like that, since he reserved a certain portion. And he told me that it hadn't had a house on it. So we had people that were into a lot of things that added to a community. Like my great-granddad's father built the first school and church over on Knolls Creek between the two, Little Knoll and Big Knoll. And now there's a cemetery there, and that's where they're buried. So I was to that cemetery just recently. Mm-hmm. And it's even odd that you can go back and chase back people even that far and find their graves and they're marked. But I don't know about Civil War, anything that I can tell you that hasn't been written or talked about or told. But
well, to me, lots of historians write about the Civil War, but
they write stories that are half made up, though.
But when a person like you, who knew your grandfather, who was there, is mm-hmm. about as best, as good a history as you can get, to my opinion.
You see, our front porch, that was cleared when I was a kid. All that that's grown up now, that was all cleared. We could sit on the front porch. I mean, he can envision these things that happened when he was a kid. The bullet going through the front door. Yes, there's a hole through the as you walk up in front of the house, the right-hand door has a bullet hole in the second board over up near the top. The next door on the other side of the house, he said we kept those closed for, you know, safety purposes. And it went into a paling fence. And we used to have the piece of, and it was handed around, and it finally came apart, and they put a little wire around it, and I don't know whatever it ended up with, but, you know, they had the pieces of the paling that it went in. But there was so much that the family had to go through, little things I know that I don't remember. But it was something we lived over and over and over, because you sat on the porch after dinner of evening. Hey, people nowadays with electricity never finish anything. Your work's never done. Families don't eat together. One eats now, another one eats later. You heat it up in a microwave. And back then, you had to have fire in a stove. Matches were, you didn't have matches. I mean, they were very scarce. And I mean, you bought some matches. I still have one of those cases that you put the old farmer matches in. So we had those, but you had to protect those on account of mice, and you didn't want a kid to get a hold of one of them. It set something afire. So you more or less kept the wood stove a slight fire in it. You didn't let it go completely out. If you needed hot water, you could kindle that up very quickly and come up with hot water for a necessity. So if somebody come along and needed a hot cup of coffee, it was soon ready. Mm. Used to have one old fellow that would come along, and he rode a mule. And if he was in a hurry, he didn't get off. He'd just ride up on the bank and talk to my grandmother. He called her Aunt Sari, and he'd talk a while. You know, everybody went out on the porch, talked to him, because you know, you were glad to see anybody coming. So, and my dad would always fix him a cup of coffee and take it to him on his mule. And it was amusing, because nowadays you would stop at a food place to get you a cup of coffee. You wouldn't stop at a neighbor and bum a cup of coffee, that's for sure. But now that was, he expected his cup of coffee, and you saw him coming, you knew he was going to have his cup of coffee. If you didn't offer it, he'd ask for it. But that was a farm that we raised. Everything that we had was raised. Nobody went out for a day's work. And I was talking about finishing the work at the end of the day. Everything had to be finished, because you either did it by lantern light. That was safe. I mean, fairly safe, unless you stumbled or fell with your kerosene light. But housework had to be finished, because lamp globes, once speck of water and it was gone. So probably even then they were 35 cents, and because that was something that had to be brought in, it was fragile, it had to be cared for, a lot different from something, oh, you know, like men's pants and so on. That was thrown in a box and that could be shoved on the wagon, and it was simple. But anything that was fragile cost more when you went to, and lamp globes was the one necessity. And we had to have everything done by dark. I mean, that meant every little animal had to be in its own coop or pen or wherever you were going to keep it, you know, for the night, so it would be safe. We had wild animals too, and you didn't venture out at night on account of something like that. If you heard the chickens, you had to have the lantern, and then it was a fox or something in your chickens, but you had to make sure that everything was penned. And nowadays, people eat all different kinds of times, and they never finish anything. Families aren't families anymore. They have just been ripped apart by electricity, I say. And electricity is still killing people. Killed some yesterday, an accident in Morgantown even. So I blame electricity, and it's been one of the wonderful things that's happened because with food storage and so on. But when you were on a farm, you had everything fresh. It was either fresh or it was dried or it was canned. Eventually they got to canning. I can remember the first little pressure cooker that was around. It was very small, and it only held about 5 pints. And one of the ladies, I don't know how she came upon this thing, but some of her kids worked it out somewhere, you know, that some of the older kids, and brought it home to her and taught her how to use it. And she canned corn for all the neighbors. Up until that time, you couldn't have canned corn. But after she got that little pressure cooker, I mean, it was like an appointment. She was to be there a certain morning, and everybody was working corn, and you soon learned how to can corn. But that was a little old thing, and you set it on the wood stove and had four little legs on it. And you could take a cap off, a small cap, and let the heat come to it real fast, and then when you got it hot, then you set that piece of cap back on or moved it over on another one so you could cook it there. But that was our first experience with that. So things were a lot different, but there was no way anyone would ever get upset from, there's a stomach upset from food that wasn't good because it was all fresh. Yeah. And nowadays, with cans and so on, I'm still leery of tin cans and food. To me, that's all right for cat food, but let's not put human food in tin cans. I'd rather have it so I could see it than that.
I'd like getting back to the wartime.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to just get a better picture of your family in this house. Your mm-hmm. great-grandfather, was it your great-grandfather's house?
Mm-hmm.
And The Union troops actually moved right in the house with them?
Yes. And I have never known. That's something I don't recall. Did they come in at this door and into that room, or did they go in and out at the window area? You see, there was a window on the front, and that was all information. I've heard them talk about the neighbors would bake pies when the troops were coming through, you know, and was going to be resting there for a group of troops. They let the neighbors know. They would bake pies, bake bread, and sold it to them. And they would, it was all brought to that window there. And it was, so it was like their PX. But I've heard them talk about the pies that the people would bake, you know, the fruit pies in the summertime, you know, apple pies, dried apple pies in the wintertime. And that, because those were the commodities that they couldn't bring in. That was something, you know, I mean, it was being brought on wagon. Remember, see, that road was just finished, and it wasn't paved. It was actually hacked out of, the trees were cut and moved out of the way, and your road was actually just like a trail, much like it is today, except we have had some stone put here and there. I've heard them talk about them bringing in the pies and the baked goods, you know, for the troops to have. And if troops were going to be moving through, we had lots of troop movement. We even had in the 23rd Ohio Volunteers, we had President McKinley. He was just a teenager. He had been at Clarksburg and Weston, and had in some of his writings where he was transferred on through here. And they were here at least for a few days. And Rutherford B. Hayes was in camp there. So it was for a time, not during either one of our battles, you know. But maybe a skirmish, I don't know about that. But they had, at one time or another, had crossed through here, you see. So we've had important people here that hasn't been played up. But we would sit on the porch at night. And my grandfather, I mean, he would look out there, and he always had his cane across his arm of his rocking chair. He always sat in a rocker on the porch, a wooden rocker with a slat bottom and back. And he always sat there. And he would tell us stories till, I mean, some of them were scary. He didn't even want to go to bed. About, you know, when they were, the skirmishes were worse than the battle, really, because they were in ambush. They crippled people, they killed people, and shot them full of holes. They found them tomorrow. The horses were dead and stuff like that. And that was, I mean, those were blood-curdling things that you didn't want to hear of an evening. I know my grandmother used to say, now, they always called, his name was Elias Heyman. They always called him Major. So Uncle Mage, he was the storyteller. But if he had, my dad not wanted to hear it, and if my uncle and my aunt, see, he had three kids. If they wanted to hear it, grandmother didn't shut him up. I mean, it was just, they wanted to hear it, they got to hear the stories. Now, us kids, small, I mean, we got raced off, you know, and let us go to bed, because, hey, we wanted us to sleep, not cry all night. But if you was killing a horse, now, that was worse than killing a human. Because, you know, an animal, that was terrible. It didn't even have a chance. But there was the one that was along the old turnpike road. You don't come up that section of it. It's down next to the river, going on down from, we don't even walk people on down that way when we're doing tours. They haven't done anything with that set of trenches down there. But there was always mystery about what they did with the ammunition, the guns, and so on, when they finally quit, you know, when they finally got. They were there from 61, 62, 63, and 64. Well, they freed the slaves in 63. War didn't stop. They were still running troops. And so they kept that going until 64. So it's, I still don't understand, except that it's communication. They were still units that weren't provided with, well, the Confederates no doubt didn't have the organization that the Union had. And them not having that organization, they were still, lots of them, in movement from place to place trying to take over some section. And this was one of them, because that it was the only place that you could cross Kanawha River and without you boated or made a raft or something, you see. So they could walk it at Falls Mills, and that was it. But they were facing each other, the two sets of the fortification and the Union, I mean the Confederate trenches were on the other hill, just about the same level. Mm-hmm. And it looks like a long ways when you look across it now, seeing the lake down there, and then and where the old road was, and then knowing where the new one is, and so on. It looks like a long ways, but they say the guns were very capable, except the cavalry guns were not. They didn't have as long a barrel, and so on. Maybe shot a different bullet, I don't know. Probably very near the same. It looks to me like they shot all the same thing. Probably bought it from the same supplier. But I think they've kind of brought that down. But we had boxes of bullets. I mean, they had bullets until they melted them down. They melted them down and put them in cans and used them for doorstops. Now that's how many bullets that we had come up with over the years, and we still had boxes of bullets. I know my sister still does. But she said, we don't have half of them anymore. Of course, they probably don't, but you know, they still have them. And she got to stay there until 83. I was 8, 9, something like that when my grandfather died. My older sisters, if they could think back, probably would remember a lot more stories than even I could from my granddad, because my sister that's just older than they, she always liked, I mean, she was kind of like grandmother's pet. I mean, grandmother always liked to take care of Ruth and see that Ruth had everything that she needed, and she helped her a lot, you know. And so she, but my granddad, his pick was the oldest girl. Of course, that was the second grandchild, but